So, Martin, just count to 10 in Welsh so he can check here.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Wow.
This podcast of Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by Travelocity. You can explore great destinations by visiting Travelocity.com. I'm Rick Steves, and this is Travel with Rick Steves. And today, we're going to Wales. I've got a friend of mine, Martin de Landowitz, in town. And I met Martin a long time ago taking a tour to North Wales. And I was visiting my favorite castle in North Wales, Carnarvon Castle. And every time I come with a group into one of my favorite castles, I hope and pray there's a good guide waiting for me. For several trips in a row, Martin was my guide, and we became friends. And one day I asked Martin, how would you like to break out of this castle and lead tours with a wider range, like all over Britain? And Martin said that would be great. And for many years, he's been helping me with our tours. Martin was born and raised in Wales. He's an archaeologist by trade, but apparently when Margaret Thatcher came in, she tightened things up, and a lot of archaeologists lost their work. Martin became a guide, and today he both guides and teaches at the University of Wales. You'll see him occasionally on the Travel Channel and the History Channel with his work as an archaeologist in Wales. And Martin spends a lot of time taking groups for us around Britain and around Wales. Martin, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
First, let's make this clear. We got Great Britain. We got the United Kingdom. I'm confused. Can you give me sort of the political lay of the land there?
Right. Britain is an island. Great Britain is a political term. So in Britain, you've got England, Wales, and Scotland. And at one time in the dim and distant past, England, the senior partner in the group, ran Ireland too. Mm-hmm. So that if you say Great Britain, you're talking about the big island, England, Wales, and Scotland. But if you say the United Kingdom, that's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, that last piece of island, for some reason or lack of it, that belongs to Britain.
Something that Ireland, Scotland, and Wales have together in common is their Celtic roots. Now, this is something that's also interesting to travelers. My understanding is a long time ago, the British Isles were inhabited by Celtic people, and then Angles came over from the mainland of Europe, pushed the Celtic people to the undesirable fringes of those islands. The Angles took the best land, and it came to be known as Angle Land or England. Yep. And you Celts had to put up with your stony peripheral zone. Is that too simple, or how does it work, Thomas?
Well, it is in a way simple, but if you think of the Anglo-Saxons coming from low-lying, let's say, dairy country, well, England was suited to their way of life, and their way of life was successful. Look, we're speaking English now. That's how successful they were. Basically, their culture, the Anglo-Saxon culture, just took over, subsumed, rather than the fire and the sword. But as soon as they came to places like Wales or Scotland, where it rains a lot and it's rocky, they took one look at it and said, nope, we don't want that. Hmm. And so it was left so that the hills and mountains of Wales and Scotland and the island defended by the sea, yes, they defended, but they defended in the sense that they made that land useless to the Anglo-Saxons rather than ramparts of mountains. The Anglo-Saxons, like the Normans or indeed the Romans before them, said, oh, to heck with this. We don't want that. It rains too much and we can't grow grapes.
So the English just kind of were satisfied with the land that fit their farming heritage.
That's right, yes.
And then it's something even similar, I think, when the Romans came, they named Ireland like the land of winter or something, right?
Hibernia, yeah.
Hibernia. And they just didn't even bother going over there.
No,
they just said,
why
bother? I mean, leave it to those Irish. It's rainy over there. Mm. Okay. Now, today England is surrounded by what's called the Celtic Crescent, and that also originally included Cornwall and Brittany in France, right? Talk a little bit about this Celtic Crescent, and what does that mean anything today?
It does. It does in heritage terms, and it does also in linguistic terms. If you picture the Celts as ultimately coming in, well, continental Europe, you can look back to that area around Switzerland and Germany, if you like. And then here's Julius Caesar, well recorded, pushing north, expunging those hated Druids. And it's only in those parts, as we've already said, that the Romans didn't like, that the Celtic heritage is stuck. Now,
Wait a minute. So Brittany, the west tip of France, was also one of those less desirable stony zones that the dominant cultures decided just to let be.
That's right.
So Celtic culture survived much more broadly than it does today in these little enclaves.
That's absolutely right. I mean, if you look at Brittany as basically a peninsula sticking out in the middle of the Atlantic, well, so too does Cornwall, so too does Wales. and so to a greater or lesser extent does Scotland. Now, Ireland used at one time to be joined to the British mainland until about 6,000, 7,000 BC. Well, that too was a peninsula sticking out into the ocean.
Now, England really is surrounded by these remnants of Celtic culture then. If you look at it on the map, you've got England, and then you've got Brittany, the west, southwest tip of England, Cornwall, which originally was a Celtic, Cornish was a Celtic language, is that
right? That's correct, yes.
And then you got, of course, Ireland, Wales, and Scotland. Is this a threat to England at all, or is that sort of history now?
No, I mean, again, this goes back to what we said. If you look at that, if you think of that area as a group of people, well, the senior one, the beautiful sister who always goes to the ball, is going to be the one with the best soil and therefore the greatest wealth, whereas the Celts were always the less pulchritudinous sisters who never went to the ball. They had nothing.
Oh, that's sad.
Yes.
Okay, well, are people still speaking Celtic? What's the status of the Celtic languages in all of those regions?
Well, Cornish is virtually dead, as is, nobody ever mentions Cumbrian. Irish is propped up, and in the west of Ireland is healthy in some parts. But of all the Celtic languages, Welsh, which is where I come from in Wales, Welsh is the one most spoken.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Does the government, the British government, support that, subsidize that in any way?
Well, since 2000, we've had our assembly. The Scots have had their parliament. And it is mandatory, it is compulsory to use the Welsh language in all official documents and processes.
Since 2000?
Yes, since 2000. And really, if you look back, it was Queen Elizabeth at the beginning of the 1600s who authorized, who commanded that the Bible should be translated into Welsh.
Why would she do that?
Because of the religious turbulence of the time. We know all about Martin Luther and Wycliffe and Huss. Well, the way to prevent religious turbulence in Wales was to bring the word of God to the people in their native tongue.
Because those three characters you just mentioned, Luther, Huss, and Wycliffe, I think they all made their mark and made their trouble also by translating the Bible from Latin into the local languages.
Mm-hmm.
Czech, German, or Wycliffe would have translated into
English. Yeah.
And that was the last straw. That got you in trouble with the Vatican back then in Reformation times.
Yeah.
Then 100 years later, or a generation later, you mentioned in the 1600s, Britain said, well, let's kind of head off this trouble by actually proactively translating the Bible into the Celtic language so those people wouldn't have the same kind of uprising that we saw in Germany, for instance.
Yeah, don't forget, I mean, we can talk about Wycliffe in England or Huss and so on. But England, I got to say, was in some ways quite progressive in that it was the king who separated with Rome rather than other people, let's say, at a lower social level.
So Henry VIII.
Henry VIII.
It wasn't just about divorce.
Oh, heck no.
That's what all the tourists say.
It was about money, the important thing in life at that time.
Okay, but back to the Celtic languages. These languages, actually, you said, of all the Celtic languages, Welsh is the most healthy. And since the year 2000, it's actually being supported by Britain.
Oh, no, since long before then. I mean, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. We have our assembly now. But, it's Britain has been supporting Welsh for quite some time.
You have your assembly. And Scotland just got its assembly back for the first time since 1711.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Scottish Parliament is meeting in Edinburgh.
That's correct.
And London is no longer threatened by that.
Not at all.
Now, my contention is, Martin, as Europe is uniting and nations are giving up sovereignty to Europe as a whole, ruled mm-hmm. from Brussels, so the whole concept of Europe, that's actually good news for the diversity of Europe because regions and small ethnic groups like Celtic groups no longer threaten, for instance, London. Therefore, London lets the Scots have their parliament. Am I getting that right, or how would you develop that a little bit for me?
I think you're absolutely right. There's an interesting dynamic here, isn't there, in that Europe is trending to draw together, where at the same time, national governments within Europe are actually letting loose the reins, aren't they?
So,
the regions are becoming stronger.
So Madrid is no longer threatened by the Catalonian people in Barcelona. Paris is no longer threatened by the Britain people, the Celtic people of Brittany. When I first started traveling, if you had a child in Brittany and you named your child a Celtic name, that child would lose its French citizenship.
Mm.
Paris was that upset and threatened by the Celts in Brittany. Yep. Now, of course, that would be ridiculous. And in the same sort of vein, Scotland has its parliament and the Welsh language is getting stronger in Wales.
I think it's a sign of maturity.
Yeah.
Nationalism is a 19th century thing. And the nations now feel sufficiently relaxed. I think to say in control is the wrong thing, but they feel sufficiently relaxed that they can give power to their minority groups.
Nationalism is a dated concept, is that what your take is from Wales?
I think it is from all over the world. I don't think you can have a concept of a country as great as the United States of America until you can actually have it, until you can see it on television or you can read about it. And therefore, if living here in Edmonds, if somebody, let's say in 1810, were to say to you, Florida, you'd have no concept. Nobody could describe it. You couldn't see it. You couldn't see the TV. And as people became able to see the boundaries of their states, as these states formed and people wanted to define themselves as nations, so nationalism developed. And that had such negative effects, doesn't it? It still does today, nationalism.
Well, the unification of Europe is in part just an attempt to get away from that so they don't have
absolutely.
Wars anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, the union of Europe is basically born out of destruction of World War II, mm-hmm. realizing, hey, there's only one way we're going to live together, and it's if we get rid of nationalism and become a collaborative, you know, multi-ethnic mm-hmm. continent that functions together as a big free trade zone. Is that what's going on?
That's what's going on, but I think you're absolutely right in that it's the fear of the unknown. That, mm-hmm. that breeds nationalism, breeds resentment. And heaven only knows we have far too much of that today. And the more we know about people, the more we understand them and sympathize them, the less likely we are to have conflict.
Well, as a Welshman, you should know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. Now, every year, five languages go extinct on this planet, which is an interesting thought.
It is.
And Celtic languages are these languages that are kind of marginally there. I mean, what is their prognosis? Are these languages going to survive?
Well, Cornish, they're trying to do CPR on Cornish. But I think it's possibly a gone thing. But I think Irish and particularly Welsh, Scottish Gaelic possibly too, but Welsh has a very strong future.
Now, is that just for people who have a respect for heritage like you or even young people in Wales? Do they go, oh, do I have to learn Welsh? Or do they actually do this with a positive spirit because they are Welsh?
It is with a positive spirit. The greatest number of people in Wales live in South Wales, which was, because of industrialization in the 19th century, the most anglicized. But now there is a greater demand by young and old people to learn Welsh in South Wales than anywhere else in Wales. And the future of the Welsh language is happy, safe, secure. And I think it's going to grow. It's a gift to the world. Any language is a gift to the world. And the Welsh language is a great gift. It's literature. You can't read Shakespeare. I'm sorry to anybody who doesn't speak English, but you can't read Shakespeare in any other language. No more can you read Kate Roberts in any other language than Welsh. And if you do, you get some of the beauty, but the actual prose, the way the words taste in your mouth is so much a part of anybody's culture.
Oh, that's great. So I don't think a lot of tourists realize that when you step into a shop in a region of Wales where people speak Welsh, people are chatting together in Welsh. They turn to the tourist without missing a beat and they'll speak English. And the tourist kind of thinks this person speaks English primarily. As soon as the tourist walks out, they turn back to their conversation and they slip back into Welsh.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I live in a huge community of seven houses and we don't use English. And it's difficult for people. I mean, never mind people that come from America. I'm talking people from the east of England who suddenly arrive, park their cars, get out, and nobody's speaking English.
So give me the polite words in Welsh. Give us all a little lesson. Because when you go to Wales, you should at least know that please, thank you, and here's to your health, right?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, they're difficult ones. Please is os gwelwch yn dda.
Wow. Os gwelwch yn awch.
Os gwelwch yn dda. Thank you is diolch yn fawr.
Boy, oh boy.
I know. Good morning is bore da. Good day is, well, we'd say bore da or plan da, depending on what part of the day.
And if you're going to toast to somebody in a pub?
Iechyd da.
Iechyd da. So yes. Iechyd da is the key word when you're in a pub in Wales. Count to 10 in Welsh.
Un, dau, tri, pedwar, pimp, chwech, saith, wyth, naw, deg.
Wow. I went to a little bookstore with my kids in Wales once and bought a children's book in Welsh. And it was a wonderful book because it had all the illustrations and the little Welsh word under it. So, you know, Dick and Jane and Dick chases the ball and the dog jumps on the tree and so on. And you have that in Welsh. And it was a lot of fun. There's one notorious town in Wales that has like the longest name of any town in Europe, I think.
Oh, you'll be referring to Llanfair Pwllwyngyll Gogeri Chwyrn Drobwll Llantysilio Gogogoch, will you not, Rick?
That's one word?
That's one word.
Say it again.
Llanfair Pwllwyngyll Gogeri Chwyrn Drobwll Llantysilio Gogogoch.
Wow, what is that? That must be a bunch of words. If you translated it literally, what would it mean, Martin?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you're asking me now. The Church of St. Mary, White Hazel, Rapid Pool, Red Cave of the Blessed Cilio, so on.
And there must have a short name for that town.
Yeah, Llanfair. Or Llanfair PG if you live on Anglesey.
This has been great. I've been talking to Martin de Landowitz, a friend of mine and a fellow tour guide from Wales. Martin, thank you very much for giving us a little insight into your culture.
Thank you very much, Rick.
This podcast of Travel with Rick Steves was brought to you by Travelocity. You can plan your next adventure by visiting Travelocity.com.